You, we heard that George Sharpock got the Nobel Prize in Physics, and he has been felicitated ever since. And I had the honor and privilege also working with him from 1989 to 1992 when he retired. He was awarded the Nobel Prize for his invention and development of particle detectors. In particular, the multi-wire proportional chamber. Something that is so simple and so trivial today, I would say, because the multi-wire chamber has come in use in every laboratory, and his idea was given a one-on-one prize share of the Nobel Prize, which means that it was a groundbreaking idea and it revolutionized the particle detection in large scale. That was very important. A quick history on gas radiation detectors. So the Geiger counter starting off in 1928, and then the proportional counter, the multi-wire proportional counter by George Sharpock, then the parallel plate counter in parallel in the 60s, Pestov counter made out of glass resistive plate chambers, for example, that was by Rinaldo Santonico, who also we had the pleasure of welcoming him in Mumbai in 2007 when we had the RPC conference here. And Dave Nygren, who invented the time projection chamber, who also got many prizes but not the Nobel Prize. Then the MSGC, and you see the t-shirt that Anton Erb is wearing, also has a MSGC on his t-shirt and makes him laugh a lot for that reason, I guess. Joe Matares, Yanis, he invented the Micromegas, which I will describe in a bit. And then all of you also heard about Fabio Sauli, who has invented the gas electron multiplier. And then, of course, there are many, many derivatives of these detectors that have now found their way in all modern experiments. The multi-wire proportional chamber, simple wires, a grid of wires making a plane together, and then just like each one of these wires can act like a proportional chamber. So that was the big idea that gave him the Nobel Prize. And immediately after that, I think in 1969, this big chamber was built and it was installed in the Omega experiment. And this invention really had very big impact. So I guess I'm speaking to a very learned audience, but nevertheless, I will very quickly just highlight the fact that the gas and electric field, these are the two things that exploit radiation detection in a gaseous detector. Delimiting the gas volume, you apply a field between an anode and cathode, and when a charged particle goes through or a photon deposits energy, you have electron ion pairs, which then start drifting respectively towards the anode and the cathodes and have gas multiplication. And in the gas multiplication, you have different regions. As you increase the field, the electric field or the voltage that you apply, and you get the proportional mode of operation, or you get into the discharge mode, and then you're fired if the detector doesn't work. So ionization chambers, which have been operating already for a very long time in the 70s and the 80s, they operate at a low voltage without any gas multiplication. So they just collect the charge that is left by the radiation, by the radiation. The pros are that good uniform response to gamma radiation. Overall, you can have an accurate reading of your dose and it can sustain very high radiation rates. But the cons are that it has very low electronic output, which means that there is no multiplication as such. Then you come to the other end, which is the Geiger-Müller tubes. They operate at rather high volts. They are cheap, of course, because you have a big discharge there and which can be measured, and you can have a large variety of sizes and applications, large output signal from the tube, and it can measure the overall doses. The cons are that it doesn't measure any radiation energy, and it has a high dead time. It does not sustain high radiation rates, and sustained high radiation levels will then degrade your gas. Now you come to the proportional counters in the middle region over here, which means that the output pulse is proportional to the energy that is deposited by the radiation. The wire chamber is a very good example of the proportional counter. And it can measure the energy of the radiation that goes through, and it can provide spectrographic information proportional to the energy. It can discriminate between alpha and beta particles, and large areas can be constructed. But nevertheless, the anode wires are delicate, and time resolution is limited between the wires. Still, enormous wire chambers have been built and operated at LEP era, for example, in many, many experiments, not only at CERN, but elsewhere, at Fermilab, and at RIC, or in the United States, in Germany, and so on. So, but I pick up one example, that is the interior of the opal drift chamber, and you see that the length is 4 meters long, which is pretty long, and 2 meters, almost 2 meters of radius, and you are measuring 159 measurements per track. With an accuracy of 135 microns and an accuracy in Z of 60 millimeters. So that depends obviously on the electronic channels and on the sensitivity of your readout electronics. Talking about big chambers, the time prediction chamber that was invented by Dave Nigrin is also a huge volumetric device, which means it gives you the information not only on X and Y, but also on Z. So that's a cylinder. As you see, in the center of the cylinder, you have the high voltage electrode, and every time you have a collision or a particle that goes through, that releases electron ion pairs in the gas volume, which drifts on the end caps, and the end caps are made into with chambers like multi-wire proportional chambers, and you are reading them out. So this has been also very revolutionary in many different experiments, and has been a powerful tool for electron colliders, for modern heavy ion collisions. As you know, also the ALICE experiment has a very big TPC, and also for liquid and high pressure noble gases for neutrino and dark matter physics program. Coming to big experiments and coming to LHC, typical detectors look like this, which I think is a picture everybody has seen before. Nevertheless, just for reminding ourselves that you have the inner pixel detectors of silicon, the tracker, colorimeters, a magnet to differentiate between the charged particles, and then the muon detectors. Now, what we will talk here are the muon detectors, because that's mainly where the gas detectors sit. The CMS muon detectors are huge, and also the ATLAS ones. So the total area if we put together, ATLAS and CMS, is 15,000 meters squared of detectors that are operating in sensitive area. We have drift tubes, we have cathode strip chambers, the resistive plate chambers, and in CMS alone we have something like 6,000 meters squared, which is a very big enterprise spread over many, many years, and it's been a long time coming together. On the CMS muon end cap, you have two end caps, which means several disks, so four stations, which have 540 chambers with 6,000 meter squared active areas, 2.5 million wires, and half a million channels. So just to show you the complexity, that when you build a detector and you operate it in the laboratory, is not the same exercise when you are building detectors for production and then you operate them in a large experiment. So cathode strip chambers are again very simple, the same principle like the multi-wire proportional chamber. So you have your wires, your cathode, and the muon goes through, and you are picking up a signal with a center of gravity. So what you get in the end is of the order, an accuracy of the order of 75 microns with this big system of meter squared that we spoke about. On RPCs, I think we have more experts in the audience, so I think I can easily skip this slide. Just to say that in CMS muon system, we have 600 chambers only in the barrel, there is some mistake here, and another 500 in the end cap. So as you see here, there are very large detectors, all of the order of 2 meters by 1.2, 1.3 meters, and they have been operating already ever since the LHC started with a rate capability of a kilohertz per centimeter squared, and they have been operating in avalanche mode. Now, looking at the classic gas detectors that we have seen, the pros are that we can make cover very large areas at a relatively low price, because if you go for fancy detectors like silicon and calorimeters, they start becoming very expensive covering the same area. And here we've been talking about football fields of detectors, right? They have rather flexible geometries and they can give you good spatial and energy resolutions. The cons are that because of the slow ion motion, you have a fast gain drop at high fluxes. So you have a space charge accumulation, a distortion of the electric field, and you have a loss of efficiency. And clearly one is limited by the interwire distance of the order of a millimeter, and the best that has been done is of half a millimeter in the thin gap chambers of Atlas. In addition, we have the problem called aging, which means that given the gases that we use, like argon and the quenchers, like isobutane or pentane or CO2 and so on, all these gases, and especially the organic gases, they deposit radicals on your wire chambers and they start looking like this after a dose, for example, of a few coulombs per centimeter of the wire. But now we are moving towards an era of high luminosity and we cannot fail, and that's very important because we have just discovered the Higgs boson and we need to study it. So that's very, very important. As you know, that we have to look at all the properties of the Higgs boson. It's of course a very big object compared to anything that we have seen before. Therefore, a new machine which is for high luminosity called the HLLHC has been approved at CERN, which is going to measure the Higgs couplings, the rare decays, vector boson scattering and so on. This is going to be, maybe also we will discover other things in this previous period up to the time when we come to the HLLHC, and therefore our goal is in CMS to keep at least the same performance as we have had up to now in run 1 and in run 2. So CMS is upgrading the muon end cap with many different detectors. Many of you are involved in that as well. There's going to be a new tracker, which are 4 pixel layers and 3 disks. Track information at level 1 triggers, calorimeters with higher granularity, and a lot of new muon end cap detectors. So let's move to what has happened meanwhile. Of course, while we were building the detectors for the phase 1 of CMS and for other experiments, there have been a lot of improvements and a lot of developments and advancements in gas detectors. So we already saw that the multi-wire proportional chamber falls in efficiency as you move up in rate because of the positive ion depositions and the distortions of electric field. Therefore, one idea was to build detectors where you are able to have exploit the advances in microelectronics and etching technologies, and this family of detectors is called micro pattern gas detectors. There one has been I will go through one by one of the kind of detectors that have been found, but before that I wanted to highlight the drift chamber, which already could in principle give you better resolution compared to the better efficiency as compared to the multi-wire chamber, simply because you can in a drift chamber you can pre-amplify and then go and amplify it at the anode. So then the positive ion formation is a bit reduced at the anode wire. Nevertheless, you have the rate capability problem because of the inter-wire spacing and loss of field in the center over here. Of course, there are corrections by adding wires and so on. So GEM, Micromegas, Ingrid and all this you must have heard. Let's go one by one. So what is a GEM? A GEM is a gas electron multiplier. This is made out of a krypton foil, which is copper clad on both sides. And once you apply few hundred volts between the top and the bottom, you have a very high field in this hole, which has been made by etching this sheet, and the thickness of this sheet is of the order of 50 microns, and the diameter of this hole is 50 microns, inter-hole distances of the order of 140 microns. The fields that we're talking about are about 50 to 100 kilovolts per centimeter, which is well into the multiplication zone, and therefore each of these holes acts like a proportional detector. So you multiply a single electron that goes through will then create an avalanche like this, and then eventually you are able to have a multiplication factor of 1000 or 1500 in every single gem hole. So the interesting thing is that your voltage is applied only across the capton, and the readout is at ground potential, which is a very big advantage in terms of operating a large detector. So if how do we make a detector out of a gem? We take the gem and we apply a drift electrode on the top and an induction electrode on the bottom, which means that you can just have a readout of whatever you can design, X, Y readout, and you get your detector the way you would like to have it. Now, if you operate several detectors in cascade, you will be able to operate a single gem at a gain of 20, for example. So your voltage that you apply is, let us say, if you get a gain of 1000 at a voltage of 300 volts in gem 1, I would like to operate it at 200 volts and have a gain of 20. But if I have three detectors in tandem, I have a gain of 8000 in the same detector. So each detector operates at a voltage which is far away from any discharge limit of the detector, and that's very important, because when you make large systems, you cannot afford to have any discharges, and this is the advantage that you get by having several gem detectors in tandem. So this is called a triple gem, and up to 5 gems have been tested, but clearly you can't just increase the number. 3 has been found to be a very good number for making large detectors. Your diffusion takes over, yes. So that triple gem has already been exploited in the Compass experiment that has been taking data now from 12-13 years. And also in the totem detector, where they are sitting at a region which is very high in rate, which is I think 10 to the 5 hertz per centimeter squared, and this has been also taking data for quite a while now.
So in the Compass detector, in the beginning gems were not there, right?
No.
So how much improvement did that
improvement in which sense?
After adding gems.
For tracking?
Yeah.
For tracking, for example, they were able to operate this detector for tracking, for muon momentum resolutions, for doing all the physics that they need to do, and also having in the center a beam killer, you know, that part. For example, they could veto the beam when there is no beam, for example, they could veto. So a big improvement was given to their tracking algorithms. So talking about the ALIS-TPC, I did mention very briefly before the ALIS-TPC, it's made out of multi-wire proportional chambers sitting on these end caps. Each one of these are big, huge multi-wire chambers. I think numbers are written here. The length is 5 meters and diameter is also 5 meters. It's an old number, I think, because I believe it is 6 and 6. Because in total, it's 13 meters long, the detector itself. Okay, so there are some limitations here, because the multi-wire proportional chamber, again, when it multiplies, it releases positive ions also, and these positive ions, they go back into the drift volume that's inside, and they then distort the field inside the volume, inside the drift volume, which this field should be very uniform, and at the moment here it's shown to be 400 volts per centimeter. So if I have positive ions drifting back inside the drift volume, the efficiency of detection will go lower, simply because the radiation, the electrons and ions, the electrons that are being created by the radiation that is created here, they will be distorted and they will not be able to move with same velocity. So this is a lot of excessive distortion that comes into the ALIS-TPC, and it is limiting to the rate, for example, the readout rate is limited to 300 microseconds, unfortunately. So just to block these ions, multiple GEM stacks have been proposed and that has been studied. So using the gas electron multiplier and using these diameters and playing with the diameters in such a way that you block out all the ions. The ions stay on one side and only the electrons are moved down. And you can look up many references where you can see how this is done. And the technical solution is that you have a four GEM stack and each of these GEMs have different geometries of the holes and pitches and so on. So there's a big paper about that. But the interesting thing is that this detector now allows practically no positive ion distortion in the LSTPC and it is under production right now. So photon detection, I was speaking to some of you earlier and you were interested in photon detection. What one has been using is a cesium iodide layer on the top layer of the GEM foil and single photons have been detected very efficiently with the center of gravity measurements for two collimated UV photon beams 200 micron apart. So this measurement is actually published here and one can look up the details. Also for cryogenic detectors, there has been applications for dark matter searches and for WIMP searches where liquid xenon is used and then in the liquid phase and then in the gas phase there is a gaseous xenon where if there is any photon that is converted here then you get a primary photon and then you get a reflection and you can actually have converters and so on. So this group of Bondar et al, they have used the gas electron multipliers over here just to multiply the electrons that are coming out and then they are detecting it. Pixel readout, again it's like a dream that you make a pixel detector out of a gas detector and this has also been demonstrated by the Medipix group and they have measured a lot of data from 55 by 55 micron pixel matrix using the GEM detector, using the triple GEM detector and a very innocuous gas of argon CO2. Then I think some of you have tried, or in India also, I think in the Kolkata group, they have tried to make thick GEMs. And this, the idea is really, why have three GEMs? Why not make just one GEM and make it thicker? So in theory, it looks good. And you can actually make these GEMs and get very high gains in single GEM. And the only difference is that why do we need three GEMs, for example, in a triple GEM, let's say, let me go back one step. Because in a single micro pattern detector, you are not able to go beyond a gain of 1200 or 1000, given the electron charge density. And the discharge probability increases if you have higher gains. That's the reason why we go to double GEMs and triple GEMs. And when we come back to a thick GEM, for example, we have to work very hard on the rim, as you see here, that will then prevent your discharges. So thick GEMs have also found applications, for example, for single photon detection with very high gas gain, few nanoseconds time resolutions, sub-millimeter position resolutions, and so on. You can take a look later. So this has been demonstrated that it is also a good viable technology. Thick GEMs for ALICE also have been used in very high momentum particle identification in ALICE, and they have been also taking data at test beam where you can see that these are the Cherenkov ring images made out of the particles that they are looking here. I don't remember which particle that was or what was the energy, but what I want to show you is that you are able to reconstruct the ring that has come from the Cherenkov radiation. Also for beamline instrumentation, you can see that there have been many applications, GEM-based TPC for beam monitoring, ultra-light single GEM for low-energy anti-proton beam profiling, and also neutron beam monitor using polyethylene converters. So these are all published articles and you can of course browse them at leisure.
Where is the anti-proton beam used?
Where? For example, for imaging, for PET imaging, for example. You're testing me. No, that's true. But on the PET, you need that. Just for colorimetry, of course, you have heard that there are the ILC, which is based, which has a particle flow colorimeter concept, and that concept has also been taken by CMS for the high granularity colorimeter, which you will hear about next week. I think there's a very big public lecture by Jim Verdi, and you will hear about it. But of course, they don't use GEMS, and this particular one, the digital HCAL, for the ILC has been elaborated with triple GEMS, and they have been, many modules have been built. Micropixel chamber, again, it's a great fun idea. It was already, invented in 1992-93, if I remember, by Steve Biaggi, and he had made exactly this detector, which was then later reincarnated by Ochi in Kobe. And the main idea is that you can have a single proportional wire kind of a pixel, which means the anode is just a dot and the cathode is all what you see around it. So it's fantastic in terms of an idea. And if you were to make large areas and you will need very high density electronics, this would be the ultimate detector. But again, the issues are how to make a very large area, just in short about this detector. For the micromegas is using a property of the gas, which is that when you go into high multiplications, then the Townsend coefficient or the multiplication factor actually saturates after you go to a certain voltage. So if you have a mesh, a very fine mesh, and you have your readout strips which are separated by few hundred microns only, or let's say here it's even 50-100 microns, and the mesh itself has a pitch of 50-100 microns, you have an asymmetric parallel plate chamber. And in this, you have the drift is big, of the order of 3 millimeters, and then very fine, very small multiplication region over here, exploiting this this property of the gas I just mentioned. And you make a micro mesh gaseous structure called the micromegas, which was invented in 1996 by Yannis. Now again, this is a single stage micro pattern detector, so the issue will always remain of having discharges. So how do you get rid of discharges? Either you break your gain into different parts, or you have a resistive electrode. Okay, so what they did eventually, that they, of course, this is just, they built a bulk micromegas, which means how, this is just describing the property of how this is built by illuminating with UV, and you develop in a chemical solution, and then finally you get your detector. With the pillars, it's already inbuilt. And then if you add a resistive layer on the bottom, where you have the PCB over here, you can have bulk resistive micromegas. This detector is also quite successful and has been exploited in many of the fields that I have already shown you before, or those kind of applications. And here I give you an example of the Atlas new small wheel of the muon system of Atlas, where these kind of modules are being built with micromegas for Atlas. I think that this will be installed in LS2. That's the long shutdown 2 in 2019-2020. Now going back a bit on the RPCs and timing, I think some of you here have been also working on timing, and the multi-gap RPC is quite successful and has been exploited in the ALICE experiment. How does it work? You have several layers of glass. In this particular example, they are floating, and you have your charged particle that goes through. And any of these electrodes which take up the potential, which will naturally follow the voltage that you have applied, will give you the signal. And that's the differential signal that you get, with which you are able to then get, and how do you get the signal? Because of the resistivity of the glass that you have used. So this is a trick which somehow exploits all the knowledge that has been learnt in the past about the parallel plate chamber and the resistive plate chamber, so putting them together in fact. And timings of the order of less than 100 picoseconds or even better, which is 60 picoseconds, have been measured with this detector. And I just heard a little while ago in one of your laboratories also you have done this measurement. So this is really great. And the only catch here I see is that the glass itself is quite expensive, the semiconducting glass. And for offering cheap detector for an experiment, this has a drawback of cost as such. So let's go further in terms of having some innovative ideas. So we know that that's the gas electron multiplier. We heard about the micromegas. We heard about the RPCs and the resistive layers. So how about putting all what we have learned together and have a fast timing micro pattern detector? Because what was missing in the GEM was to have to somehow overcome this 3 millimeter of drift. So how about we take the drift 3 millimeters and we divide it into 3, and we have a cascade GEM but with resistive layers on top and the bottom. So the overall structure, just like the MRPC or the multi-gap RPC, is transparent to the signal, and the signal can be extracted at each amplification stage. So this idea can now be done because you can roll out GEMs or this kind of material by the meter. So this was a big improvement, and we made the first detector very recently. Actually, last year the first detector was made, and we were very happy when we first saw the signals coming out of these detectors. And clearly it is a long way to go from building a small detector in the lab and building large improvements. Of course the goal will be to use them in CMS somewhere, but that imagine that the micro pattern detectors we are talking about, like the GEMs and the micromegas, they were invented in the 90s, and nobody was ready to use them in big experiments until we had good experience with them. And therefore for detectors that we are inventing today, it will take another, if not 20 but 10, 15 years to be able to come and stand and defend the product for a big experiment. Now talking back about the end cap, again the example I'm using is CMS simply because I know it best. So the detectors that have been placed here, they have been built starting in 2003 and some even before that. And these detectors have started taking data, as you know, and they will continue taking data until 2020, 2025, 2030, 2035 maybe. Let's see whether they can sustain this the radiation that they will get. Of course, when these detectors were being designed, and I was very much involved in testing the aging properties of these detectors, the multi-wire chambers and the RPCs, at a facility which is called the Gamma Irradiation Facility at CERN. And the benchmark that was used was 10 LHC years. Today, the benchmark has changed to 20 LHC years. That if we want to put forward a detector for approval, let's say, we should have demonstrated that this detector stands 20 LHC years. And so the detectors that are sitting here have all demonstrated, at least in the lab, that they can stand 10 LHC years, which of which much has already gone. So, and we cannot do anything from now until 2025. We can of course play with the electronics and try to reduce the working points and so on. So there are other tricks that one can play. So just in CMS, for example, let me quickly give you some line of thought on how we are dealing with improving the system. Let's look at the end cap. Please take a look at this plot here. In the central ETA region, we have the highest rate and no sorry the lowest rate of particles and the highest number of detecting layers, just to be so solid and robust in the center. While in the end caps, if you look from ETA 1.5 onwards, if you look on either side, you have the highest rate and the lowest number of detecting layers. So we have a weakness in CMS, and this weakness is overcome, and this is going to be a big challenge because the rates are going to increase as we start running with higher luminosities, which are coming at a rather fast pace. So the gem detector, which I already presented some time ago in this auditorium, I think, so I have just few slides on that, is what was proposed, and we have started building a triple gem detector for CMS for the end caps. And let me just go back one step. And here is the end cap of CMS, the nose as we call it. This is the big disc. So in the nose, we are talking about GA11 detectors, which are over here. That's the nose, the crown of the detectors, and two different sizes of detectors. And these have been built. And what does it bring? It brings with it a big reduction in the rate, or the fake rate or fake triggers that we see in CMS because of lack of data coming from that zone in CMS. With these detectors, we will be able to see, we will be able to measure the bending angle along with other detectors that are already sitting there. So you add the triple gem detector along with the CSC, you are able to differentiate between a 5 GeV muon and a 20 GeV muon, and you can reduce the trigger rates. So that's why this detector was finally allowed to be proceeded in terms of R&D, and we made several detectors. Some of them are in the labs, and project continued, and finally in September last year this was approved. So it's just to give you an example of how long, or at least it took a good 6-7 years, even knowing the technology, to actually build a prototype that can operate in the environment that you want it to operate. This will be installed in 2019. So starting from 2009, going to 2019, imagine that the time it would take to even establish a project where you want to install these detectors. So it's a big challenge in front of us for the future experiments, where of course playing in the lab is one thing and it's great fun, you have nice new ideas and let me play and let me get a signal, oh yes I can measure, but then building a big experiment is a completely different ball game. So now that you know how to build very large detectors, we can apply them in very different fields, right? So let's talk about muon tomography for homeland security. For example, when big trucks are moving from one state to the other, or from one country to the other, or for example, containers are moving from one place to the other, there is always a need for looking for heavy elements like uranium or tungsten and so on, or whatever is sitting inside, I don't know, kind of embargo material sitting inside. So for that, our collaborators built a very large system, something that is looking like in your laboratory that I have just seen. And there we have used a triple gem and used different elements, and we are able to detect each of these elements. And this was proposed as by our colleagues in Florida for muon tomography for homeland security, and the project was approved, and they have been also published in The Economist as a matter of course pride that gas detectors are being used for muon tomography. Speaking about rock masses and density measurements and so on, again, you know, you have cosmic rays, you already have a means of using these cosmic rays by exploiting and making large detector systems, where you will be able to say, you will be able to characterize the movements of rocks or the fractures that exist in geological terrains. So this is also being exploited. Luggage inspection, I think all of us are very familiar with that. At every airport or even in shops or anywhere you go, there's always a need of luggage inspection food inspection, defect scanning, and many, many examples exist already in the literature where germ detectors and other detectors have been used for these applications, which is luggage inspection, food, and defect scanners. Improving digital imaging. So this is very important, and I think it's we all know how important it is that if there is a tumor, for example, in this particular case, having a digital image improves dramatically the contrast and then dramatically the treatment that the patient will get. And all that has revolutionized with modern detectors and modern algorithms and modern imaging techniques. So just to quickly show you, I have been trying to explain what difference gas detectors have made in the understanding of particle physics and also of the Standard Model and so on. But it really takes a long, long time and a huge number of people. So just imagine that when the LHC was being thought about, I was still studying. Then when the first collisions happened in LEP and I was a summer student at CERN, then LHC was approved. I was working on drift chambers and TPCs. Let's take another example. First cosmic scene in ATLAS. I was working R&D on MSGCs and GEMS. I start working on R&Ds on RPC as well. That was 2005-2006 when we validated the Bakelite for LHC detectors, because I think some of you might remember the Lindsay-Rayl problem in RPCs, and that was a very big step in this particular time. Starting R&D on GEMS happened in 2008-2009. And in this period between 2003 and 2009, I was building detectors to be installed in 2008-2010 and so on. So cutting the story short, it just takes long. So we should not give up that, my result is not good today. You know, it's a long way to go and a lot of factors that affect your own work. So with that note, I would like to close. Just with the promise that gaseous detectors have a tremendous future at the future machines and experimental upgrades. What are we doing there? We are answering questions about how the universe works, and by doing that, we are stimulating advances in technology and instrumentation. Thereby, we are also training tomorrow's scientists and engineers, and clearly we cannot do this alone. We have to work together, and we work together in teams, not only in national teams, but international teams, and therefore also we are bringing together nations through science. Thank you for your attention.
So, thanks, Archana, for this comprehensive overview of the gaseous detectors. Questions?
Maybe I have a small one. Yeah. While you're talking about pixel one, like by using the gas detector,
about it also depends on the electronics that you have, but given the diffusion, we are always limited to something like 70 microns or 50-70 microns. I think there is 45 microns is a record by Micromegas. Yeah. Right. Right, right. Now, when you construct the detector, you're talking about the particular case of the triple gem, right? So, when you're constructing the detector, you're building it in a clean room, which is of class 1000 ISO 6. And you clean all the components before you assemble the detector, and the detector is completely closed. Your gas loop is closed, and you do not allow dust to enter the gas volume. And this is very important, as you rightly point out.
I have two somewhat related questions. When you talk about time projection chambers,
Optical Okay, so optical means that you are, it's somewhat between colorimetry and the wire chambers. Is that, am I getting it correctly? Scintillation, scintillation, right? Right, right. Right. I think that at this level, or at least in the volumes that we are talking about, the detector itself is almost of the order of 50 square meters. And here, if you have, you need a lot of pixels to be able to grab every light over there. One example I can think of is the CMS electromagnetic calorimeter. There you have 80,000 crystals, and these crystals are grabbing the light that has been generated, and you have PMTs, the silicon PMTs, I think. And so this has been used, but not in a TPC mode. I'm afraid I won't be able to answer very much more on that. Yeah.
Right. You are
it has been used, yeah. There's a group in Israel, Weizmann group, they have really pioneered working with liquid xenon and with high pressure xenon and as a photon detector. So I would encourage you to take a look at their work and Breskin, yeah, exactly, so you know. Maybe the collection efficiency is better because in liquid you have a lot of recombination which you do not, which you are not able to extract. The efficiency of the photoelectron conversion is what dominates your efficiency, and I think that in the gas scintillation that is better than in the liquid. Again, just speaking on my feet. It's very important. Yeah, it will be deteriorated, so you need a diamond coating on top, something like that, I mean, because it's very important. After some time, you will deteriorate, the surface will deteriorate, of course, and so you need to protect that. So there are ways and means to make the cesium iodide coating, and then there is another coating on top. I think it's diamond, but you should check. Thank you. Okay, I promise.